So by popular demand, he asked me to speak about this topic, Christian influence on Judaism. Now, we have had, of course, a very contentious, often bloody relationship with Christianity for 2,000 years. It's understandable to the extent that Christianity grew out of Judaism. It's an offshoot of Judaism to some extent. And we rejected Christianity, root and branch. The narrative, the premise, the ideology, and especially the way it distorted the Torah. The contemporaries of the early Christians were the Tanaim. Obviously the Christian story unfolded in the land of Israel as well, and they completely rejected it, as did overwhelmingly most of the Jews who lived in the land of Israel at the time. And therefore the advances that Christianity made in the first two centuries of the Common Era were in the pagan world and not really in the Jewish world. The traditional question, the common question people always ask, is how did Judaism shape Christianity? And there are reams and reams written about that, but this is actually the opposite question. How has or has Christianity influenced Judaism? What do you think? Any ideas? How has Christianity influenced Judaism? You can hand it out. The answers are right there. Now, we have to concede that...
The way we set up our shuls?
That's good. Okay, we'll get to that. Very good. We have to concede that for whatever reason, Christianity became the dominant religion in the world. It's begun to struggle in the last 500 years or so, and now is in decline in much of the Western world and even elsewhere as well. Now, be careful in being precise in talking about Christianity, because there's so many different denominations. You know, we struggle with Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, and what have you. But they have dozens and dozens of different denominations. Catholicism, which with it began, was always the dominant, the most prevalent one. But that now that's really in decline. I just saw in the Wall Street Journal yesterday that Brazil, which is the largest Catholic country in the world, by this summer will have a minority Catholic population for the first time, as there the Pentecostals are taking over. But nonetheless, so before we get, what do you want to say? Got a suggestion?
Certainly we've had a lot more strong-arming. Halacha allows for leniencies that Christian halacha doesn't, and I think that...
Like what?
A lot of Jewish halacha takes into account like time and place, and stuff like that. Halacha changes with society, but Christian halacha...
Well, not always, but give me an example you're talking about.
A topic that I've been researching lately is abortion.
Okay.
So there are a lot of... A lot doesn't make it seem that there are a majority of cases that are like this, but there are a lot of exceptions where women would be allowed to have abortions that if we would just follow Christianity, it's
right. But you wouldn't say that Christianity has shaped the Jewish view. In other words, we have our own integrity. We come about our view the own way.
I would say that it's been morphed. Maybe not with rabbinim that are posthumate, but like I think that a lot of Jews' gut reactions are
right. Well, let's put it with gut reactions.
Are you not talking about gut reactions?
No, not at all. Even in the case that you mentioned, I would say that we do not fit comfortably into either group. In other words, the pro-abortion movement, say in America, you wouldn't say that Judaism is pro-abortion.
But in terms of
pro-life, they're really absolutists. In other words, that abortion is never allowed, and we don't maintain that either. So, but I wouldn't therefore posit that they've influenced our view. Rather, our view is independent. We've always had this view, and the nuances that can be discussed, what, you know, how you determine health of the mother, psychological factors, etc., but that's not to say that they've influenced it. I want to focus on areas that they influenced our practice.
That we can like have a one-to-one correlation?
Yes.
Okay.
You see a direct result of something within Christianity that influenced Jewish life. But before we start that, I want to emphasize, so Rambam did see a purpose in Christianity. So we start number one in Hilchot Melachim Perek Alef Halacha Dalid. It's a famous Rambam, really at the end of the Arach HaZakah, and it was censored by the Christians. Af Yeshua HaNotzri Shadimashia Mashiach V'Nerag Bevetin, even Jesus the Nazarene, who pretended to be Mashiach and was killed in Beitin, Kvar Nitma Bebosh Daniel. Daniel already prophesied about him. And the wanton ones of your people, they will push themselves forward to lead, to rule, to have a particular vision, and they will stumble. Is there a greater stumbling block than this? All the Nevi'im spoke about the Mashiach as the Gol Yisrael, the one who saves us, Mekabetz Nidcheyem, Mechazek Mitzvotan, strengthens our observance of Mitzvah, V'zegram La'Beid Yisrael B'cherev, L'Fazer She'etam L'Ashpilam. And this one caused the Jewish people to be destroyed by the sword, to scatter our remnants, and to bring us low. Think about it, when did Jesus die? About 40 years before the Churban. So he was in that era of great turmoil in Jewish life. And to exchange the Torah for something else, and to distort most of the world to worship God, a God other than Hashem. We can't apprehend all of God's thoughts. His ways are not, our ways are not his ways, our thoughts are not his thoughts. V'chol dvorim o'elu shel Yeshua Notzri v'shel Zay Yishmeili Shomer Acharav Muhammad Einon Eli Asher Derech LeMelech HaMashiach Ulu Takenet Olam Kulo Lavodat Hashem B'Yachad. Their purpose is to straighten the path to the Mashiach and to rectify the world, repair the world, so that we will all together serve Hashem. As the Pasuk says in Tzafanya, Ki Oza Pochel Amim Safo V'ra, then Bimota Mashiach, all the nations will turn with a clear language. Likro kulam b'shem Hashem, ulavdo shchem echad. We'll all call out the name of God. We will all serve Him as one. How? So this is the purpose. Kvar nitmale olam kulo midivrei Mashiach, midivrei Torah, midivrei Mitzvot. That the world, because of Christianity and Islam as well, there's now talk of Mashiach. Islam has the concept of a 12th Imam. And they talk of the Torah of Tanakh, and they talk of commandments, mitzvot. Meaning it's an elevation over paganism. U'pashtu dvarim elu b'iyim rechokim v'amim rabim arele lev. And these words, these notions of Torah, mitzvot, Mashiach, divine morality, etc., was propagated into the most far-flung islands of the globe and to many nations. And they discuss it, and they discuss the mitzvot. Some will say of these groups that there were mitzvot, but now they've been nullified, they've been transcended, superseded in the language of the trade. And we don't observe them generations already. And others say that they're allegories not meant to be observed. Mashiach came, Messiah came, and revealed their hidden aspects. So they know of it. They may have gone down a distorted path, but they know of it. When the true Mashiach comes, it'll like ring a bell in their minds. They'll be right away, oh, I recognize this. They'll realize that they were bequeathed falsehoods by their fathers, and their prophets and ancestors led them astray. But nonetheless, at least they're in the Parsha, as opposed to paganism, worshiping the sun, the moon, trees, statues, etc. So in that sense, it's an advance. Now, I have to tell you that nevertheless, the Rambam does hold unequivocally, it's Avodah Zarah, it's number two. It's also censored. And that's all the halachas have had to deal with them on Sundays. But he holds explicitly that Christianity is idolatry. Now, you see number three, in 2015, there was a statement that was issued by about two dozen liberal Orthodox rabbis. Many of the names I knew, called to do the will of our Father in heaven toward a partnership between Jews and Christians. And they wrote, and this is the relevant part for us, I didn't sign, by the way, because I was against this hashkafa, but they wrote as follows, as did Maimonides and Yehuda Halevi, we acknowledge that Christianity is neither an accident nor an error, but the will, divine outcome, and gift to the nations. In separating Judaism and Christianity, God willed a separation between partners with significant theological differences, not a separation between enemies. Okay, why didn't I sign?
Does it make sense
equal? What's that?
It makes us equal with Christianity.
Yeah, but it's not true. I mean, we just read the Rambam. Would you read that Rambam and deduce from that that Christianity is a will, divine outcome, and gift to the nations? Would the Rambam have ever suggested that Christianity is Avodah Zarah, and therefore it's a gift and a partnership with us, that we just have significant theological differences? V'haraya, if this statement, and the Kuzri is no different, by the way, if this statement was so pro-Christianity, why would they censor it? They should have trumpeted it, put it in bold with italics. Only censor, because the Rambam basically is saying it's false, but it has a value. It has a value, and therefore there are consequences to Christianity and Islam that could be positive. Meaning, like I said, they move the world away from paganism. But that's not the same as saying there's a partnership or that it is part of the Ratzon Hashem in the ultimate sense that that exists. So that's why I did not sign. The usual suspects did, and kach it is. But nonetheless, are there influences? And the answer is yes. So take the simplest one. Number four, it's a famous Taz in Siman Chet, in Orach Chaim, Sifkat and Gimel. The Taz is speaking there. It begins the laws of Tzitzit, but he references what he had written earlier in Siman Bet about a yarmulke. So a kippah is traditional Jewish dress now for quite a while. He mentions the Gemara Kiddushin. It's the third line. Ho gavra de la machase reshe. They saw a certain man who had his head uncovered in public, and they said, Kama chotzav haigavra, what a chutzpanik, how insolent that person is. Ugedole chachamim nimnim milagalat rosham liot ashchina chofefet b'sochechet otan. And the greatest of the chachamim refrained from baring their heads because the shchina was hovering above them. Why do we wear a yarmulke? So there are a number of reasons why, traditionally. One, yarmulke, some say the etymologists, that it's a contraction of Yiramalka, meaning Yir HaShemayim. We show Yir HaShemayim by placing a kippah on our heads. Or, why do we wear yarmulke on our heads? Because we want to humble our intellect. We need intellectual humility. Since man's mind is the great gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nevertheless, we shouldn't think that our intellect is going to transcend his, but rather, we have to be modest and realize that God's thoughts and greatness are greater than ours in a way that even we can't understand. So those are the traditional reasons, but if you go to the first line, the Taz expanded it from what was considered a midat chasidut, an act of piety, of humility before God, to a religious statement. V'nir elishesh iser gamur mitam acher. He says, seems to me there's a total prohibition stemming from another reason, dahainu kevon shechoku achshav bein akum, shosim keng tamid, tekev shoshrin, porkin ma'aleim akova, vimkein zenichal b'chlal uvchukadeim lo teilechu. Since the custom amongst the Christians is to walk around bareheaded, you wear a hat in public, you enter someone's house, you take off your hat. You enter your church, your church. You don't have a church. You enter a church. They enter their churches. Nobody sits bareheaded. In fact, it's considered an act of rudeness and impiety to sit bareheaded. So therefore, the Taz says at the bottom, Mikomakom. So three lines from the bottom. Vaday yarchik atzmo b'zayotem mishachukotem. We have to distance ourselves from this bareheadedness even more from other practices that they have. Mikomakom mashakatav rashal didai bekiso heyad al arosh vaday dai bozaf l'saik chukotakom. For these purposes, not to be similar to non-Jews to Christians, it's enough to put a hand on a head. That won't be enough for making a bracha, by the way, but just to remove ourselves from the klal of chukot ha'akum, any type of covering suffices, even a head, even a hand. Kevan shumora bozesh osu l'leisha begilui harosh. Avo lo yoy l'inyan sheyatza devar kudusha mipiv. You still can't say a bracha. So Taz says openly that the primary reason why we wear a yarmulke, said a different way, a yarmulke was a minig. The Taz made it into a chiyuv, an iser, to walk around bareheaded because of chukot ha'akum, because of the Christian practices at the time. Now, think about it. The Taz died in 1667, so he lived in Poland. Really, from his time on, it's become definitive Jewish dress. A person wants to be a Jew in public, we identify a religious Jew, an observant Jew, by the kippah. By the way, it doesn't always mean that they're observant, but nonetheless, it's a statement that they make. All right, what else? Tfilah. Look at the Tamei HaMenhagim in number 6. For some reason, I have no 5 here. There must be a symbolism to that. Tam Shein Labari L'chol L'shlav O L'shalev Ha'etzbot She'yamim Shal Smol Kim Kochot El Yonim Yaminiyim U'smolim Vein Larbem. It's the Mavra Yabok. Alright, what are we talking about? I remember this when I was a child in yeshiva. So Christians pray like this. Ever see this? With their fingers interlocked. I remember when I was in Yeshiva Katana, then the Rebbeim believed in corporal punishment. If a person ever even sat like at a desk like this, he'll come over and whack your hands to take it apart. All right? So it's based on Kabbalah, the sacrament of Eri, not to do that, because to interlock the hands, he says, you are commingling the Kochot Elyonim, Kochot Tachtonim. Whatever it is, I don't doubt at all that even in the Ari's time and beyond that, to hold your hands like this, certainly in prayer, was considered Christian prayer, and we don't do that. Nor in 7, Rabbi Kiva Eger writes, Ein anu mitpalim brisat yadayim. Nor do we extend our hands like this to heaven, kei v'chashav umos osen kein. That's how the Christians pray. They pray with their hands out like this. All right? There's a famous statue of Yeshu HaNotzri on the campus of Notre Dame. Ever hear of that? It's called, it's a big football university, Notre Dame. He's like this, and it's known there as Touchdown Jesus, because that's how he's signaling. But that was a change in the way we actually davened. Think about it. We read this in Sedra 2 weeks ago at the end of Vo'era. After the Makkah of Barad, what did Moshe say to Paro? Kitzeti et ha'ir, when I go out of the city, Ephros et kapay el Hashem, I'll lift my hands to God. So you see, lifting hands was a traditional way of Jewish prayer. Not anymore. Now, where do you still find it in Jewish life? Eidot HaMizrach. You'll see, they'll daven like this, all right? Because they weren't affected by any Christian influence. Now, the truth is, Muslims pray like that as well, very frequently. They'll hold their hands like this in the air. But nonetheless, the Sephardic Jews do not have the same aversion to that as Western Jews do, Ashkenazim, because of the Christian influence. All right, where else do we see this? It's mentioned also by Rav Moshe Feinstein in number 8. This Truva in Eben Ezra Chelek Gimel Siman Yud Ches, he's talking about the double ring ceremony at marriage. So we know that marriage, Kiddushin, is a unilateral act. The husband gives something of value to the wife. Today it's a Tabat, In the past, sometimes it was a coin, but something of value has to be transferred from the husband to the wife, and she accepts it. It's not a bilateral act. It's not a mutual act. There's a giver, a notein, and there is a mikabela. So Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that it's asur. It's a lo mebayim minag anochrim hu gain. It doesn't matter. It's a minag anochrim. That's isur d'oraisa in its own right. But even if not, it's a chok hevel ushtud. Now, it's not to say that they created this halacha. They didn't create the halacha, because our standards are clear. It's a unilateral act. But nonetheless, if you think of the typical Christian ceremony, it always involves the priest or minister saying to the couple, do you take this man, ba-ba-ba, to live, to love, to cherish, etc.? And do you take this woman, or sorry, start to the man, do you take this woman to love, honor, cherish, etc.? And then do you take this man, all right? And now it's actually quite common for each party, to give a ring and take the vow when they are giving the ring. Meaning, there is a mutual gift and receipt. And that's how marriages are contracted, not in our world. And Rav Moshe says that is osin kechok shalohem. A person who wants to have a double ring ceremony is basically embracing Christian practice, which involves a mutuality of commitment in the marriage ceremony, as opposed to the unilateralism of the Jewish act. What else? Turn the page. Number 9. This is actually quite well known. I have to tell you, I acted upon this myself when I got married. It's the Chatam Sofer, Chelek Gimel, Eben Ezer, Aleph, Siman Tzadi Chet. There the Chatam Sofer says, Yesh l'tamoa al minag Ashkenaz shel achshav bizmanenu. Afo pishanagu b'chupat mine. Mikol makom osim gam achupa im zayin bracho, tachat raki b'chatzer beit ha-knesset. Vein shum makom b'chol Ashkenaz osim chupa beit ha-knesset. He says that it's unheard of in Ashkenaz to make a wedding in a shul. You ever hear of a wedding in a shul?
Usually it's like a very small wedding.
No, sometimes they have big wedding halls.
I've seen weddings and wedding halls, and the closest I've seen to a wedding in a shul that I can remember is a wedding in the Howard Shul had a wedding garden.
In Europe or in America?
In America.
There are plenty of weddings and shuls in America. Okay. I mean, when years ago, the Great Nick Synagogue, when I was young, there was like one of the most popular venues for a wedding, because they had a nice hall as well. It's actually pretty common. In Teaneck, Romer hosts weddings all the time, big weddings. I know there are conservative reform temples that are built essentially as adjuncts to catering halls. Meaning the main source of revenue is the catering hall, and they just attach the place of prayer alongside it. But the Chatam Sofer said that in Ashkenaz it's not done, and he said it's not done because it's usur to be done. Why is it usur? Because of Chukot Akum. The church wedding is a staple of Christian life. The question he was dealing with is, could you have a wedding in the Chatzer Beit HaKnesset? That's what he's dealing with. So he said, we have it outside, Siman HaTov HaKechavim, all right? But nonetheless, we follow Raman, have it outside, alright? Anyone who wants to do like that, they're not zocha to the bracha of that will have descendants, kichochlea shamayim. Chatam Sofer said it's usher to do, because to have a wedding in a shul, a makam tefillah, is no different than you're just paralleling the church weddings, and that is a din of chukot akum. So in fact, I don't know how common it is. I could tell you that when I got married, that was the only condition I placed on having a venue. It should not be in a shul, based on the Chatam Sofer. But I'm pretty much in a minority. Although the truth is, like you said, because weddings are so large, many shuls cannot host such large assemblages, so therefore there are catering halls that tend to it. But nonetheless, you have this Chatam Sofer as well. What about something else about marriage? All right, what existed in ancient times that doesn't exist today? Polygamy. All right? See, here you have a famous tshuva of the Yavetz, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Chelek Bet Siman Tetvav. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, so why is there no polygamy today? It's the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, banned it around the year 950, almost 1100 years ago now. 950, I'm sorry, not 1100 years, 10 and a half centuries. Why did he ban it? So,
never went well.
What's that?
Never went well.
It is a problem. I mean, I could see that there'd be a problem. Usually the first wife objects. He felt also that, I mean, again, he didn't state his reasons for it, but the Rishonim tried to ascertain them, that it was men would marry multiple women and not be able to support them, not be able to keep them happy, not be able to pay the ketubah amount if the marriages did not work out. And therefore, they would just leave and strand many women as agunot, and he said it would not, that could not work. Rabbi Yaakov Emden had a different understanding of it altogether. And he said that the reason Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola banned, remember he was from Mainz in the Alsace-Lorraine, the Rhine region, the Rhineland of Germany, the western part of Germany. He held, Rabbi Yaakov Emden held, the reason he banned polygamy was because Christians were monogamous. And because Christians were monogamous, it would not look good if Jews were polygamous. That could not hold. So here we are, number 10. The Hinele Rishana Nogel Gzert Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola. Oh, so by the way, the truth itself is actually pretty infamous. It's Rabbi Yaakov Emden's support for, not polygamy, but for Pilagshut. So Pilagesh, a concubine, technically, a Pilagesh is a woman who has an exclusive relationship with you, but there's no Kiddushin and there's no Ketubah. All right? So he felt that should be restored in Jewish life. He didn't understand why it would not be, and he blamed the Christians for it. And he said, "Milvad shelo nishpata gzeirato b'chol ratzot, l'kal b'chol Yisrael." He said, "Rabbeinu Gershom's gzeira should not pertain here because it was not accepted throughout the Jewish people, nor in every land. Ki ratzot ha'marav mizrach l'chol haklal, in Arabia it didn't exist at all." Rak b'mdinat Ashkenaz levada, only in the Western communities, v'zem b'nei chamat ha-metzik, that's because of the wrath of the tormentor, meaning the Christians, she'ena matirin l'adam l'kachat yoter mishtei nashim, shu atzlam l'avon eshet ish yechashev. They don't permit some to take more than two wives. I think it's a misprint. They don't permit you more than one wife, all right? That is to say, they don't permit you to have two wives. That we mingled amongst the nations and we learned from their deeds. So he says the negative thing that we learned from their deeds, not to have multiple wives. It should be abolished on that basis. That essentially we are following not Torah practice, but Christian practice in limiting ourselves to one wife. And besides that, the Gzera should have existed only to the end of the fifth millennium, all right, which is 782 years ago, or some cemented for 1,000 years, which case should have expired in 1950. Aval bar mendein, havel de losa, we shouldn't add to it. That's one thing, not to take another wife, but a pilegesh. How could there be any objection to that at all? And he speaks glowingly of the value of a pilegesh. I mean, look, Avram had one. Yaakov had four wives. One, mitzvah piria verivya, you bring more Jewish children into the world. And not just if one wife can't have children, but generally you have many wives and many children, so you'll be more Jews in the world. Some don't want to have a pilegesh because of a kesher amitz shebeinahem. Some because of the strong relationship between husband and wife. You love your wife, you don't want any other. I used to say this on the chuppah occasionally. why is the paradigm for marriage Adam and Chava? We mention them in two, even three brachot under the chuppah, Sheva brachot. Why? Because I said Adam didn't play the field. Chava was the only one for him, because she was the only one in the world at the time. That's how a husband has to see his wife, is the only one in the world for him. All right, notwithstanding that he disagreed. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, by the way, married three times, but kosher way, his first two wives unfortunately died. I think he had over 15 children as well, so he did contribute a lot of many descendants to Jewish life. Or because you can't pay the ketubah, that's why people did it. But a pilegesh, there's no ketubah, there's no kiddushin, it's completely different. And he goes on to say why it should be permissible to take a pilegesh, and he says at the bottom, one line above the bold, v'gam kedei larbot zera Yisrael uvedin sheyasru umot alehen yoter me'achad shebelav hachi emra mitzarech el yishuv amdina. So we need more Jews. They want to maintain population control. It would have been appropriate, therefore, to prevent, to get rid of this prohibition because of the Isser of Chukot Akum. They do it. They have that prohibition. We don't. Rak mishum shu b'shev al tase v'gam mechamat ha-sakana le-yehudim ha-shachnim bein ha-reilim, and also because of the danger that would pertain to Jews if we started taking multiple women when we're dwelling amongst the uncircumcised. U'kshenosim shtei nashim hutzrach ha-begenim shemar gola l'gzor isur zeh shelo min adin. What Rabbeinu Gershom did was not halachic, it was a takana. He says we should abolish that takana, ki lo bo lide takana zo elim emnei sakanat arelim. It's not because it was sakana to take multiple wives. Now, we should understand that, first of all, don't try this at home, because even Rabbi Yaakov Emden said that the pilagshim require, there's still certain halachic parameters. And secondly, he refused to say it's mutter unless he had the approbation, the haskama, of the other gedolei haposkim of his generation, which of course he did not have. But note, the only reason he says why this is asur is because that's the custom amongst Christians. But for Jews, it should be permissible as well. Solve the singles problem in one fell swoop. Of course, it will create many other problems nonetheless. Now, some have interpreted Rabbi Yaakov Emden to mean that on moral grounds we have to ban polygamy or pilagshut because the Torah can't appear to be less moral than other religions. So the truth is, I did not see that in the tshuva. Sometimes the later writers will project onto a tshuva what they want to see. And besides, it presupposes that polygamy is inherently immoral, which is hard to posit when the Avot did it, Avram and Yaakov and the kings of Israel did it. See, he felt there's an interest in pur vu, and also he writes as a siag la'avera. Men sin, men are, they can't resist. And when their wives are nidot, so it's difficult. So therefore, he said, if Pilagshot will solve this problem. All right, so that's what he writes. I don't recommend it for anybody here, or myself for that matter. My wife would kill me, so that wouldn't happen in any event. But nonetheless, you see how he, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, saw how Christianity influenced Jewish practice in such a dramatic way. All right, number 11... The Sridei Eish writes this about funerals. He was asked, can you put flowers on on graves? Ever seen a Jewish grave with flowers?
Stones.
Stones, not flowers. Why not flowers? For this reason. So Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg wrote in the Sridei Eish, Chelek Bet Siman Kuf Zayin, Valdat Netiat Prachim Al Kvarim, look at the Melamed Lahoil of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, quoting Rav Hildesheimer, quoting Rav Hirsch. They all agree, lesser mishum chukot agayim. It's because Christians place flowers on graves, Jews do not. Apropos of that, so you don't have the text in front of you, But apropos of that, the Vilna Gaon prohibited bringing flowers and trees into shuls. On what holiday?
Circus.
Shavuot. On Shavuot we decorate. It's a meaning of the Ramah quotes. You bring in greenery into the shul, Dugmat Har Sinai, which was verdant at the time of Matan Torah. The Gros said that we are not allowed to do, because that also is Christian practice, bringing flowers and trees into shuls.
Wait, so it's a problem, like some just have greenery in a shul?
Well, that's the Gros Minig. I think the Gros is overruled by common practice.
I was going to say, my shul is...
Yes, right.
We have fake greenery.
It's Keneged HaGros. No, people buy bouquets and plants would have for Shavuot, be there for days. It's common practice, but it's Keneged HaGros. You should know, the Gros was one of the great geniuses of the last 1,000 years, but even in Vilna they didn't follow every psak that he had. He wasn't the Rav of the town. What else do we find? What other halachot had to be nullified, or at least moderated, because of the Christian influence? There's an explicit halacha in the Gemara Shulchan Aruch. The shul has to be the highest building in town. All right? Everyone should look up to the shul. Unfortunately, the Christians had the same law that the church. That's why they have these steeples to make it even higher. If it can't be, they held the church has to be the highest building in town. So that went by the wayside, and now we're not makbid on that even in the land of Israel. But another point is interesting. You see a difference in Sephardic practice and Ashkenazi practice. And that is the notion of bima ba'emtza. Bima ba'emtza, having the bima in the middle of the shul. Like here you have the amud, which the Shlech Tzibur davens. I guess you read the Torah from here, correct?
Yeah.
Yes. And nobody davens from here. So Ashkenazic shuls always had that distinction between the teva, from which the Shlech Tzibur davened, and the bima, the shulchan, from which the Torah is read, which is always in the middle of the shul. In fact, there's a minig that there should be two rows, at least two rows, between the shulchan and where the chazan davens, so it's be'emtza. Why? It's dugmat Har Sinai, in theory, that at Har Sinai, the Jewish people surrounded Har Sinai. We didn't stand on one side of the mountain and hear, Anoch Hashem Elokecha, but rather we ring the mountain. So therefore, from the place that the Torah is read, is Dugmat Sinai, it's read of the Jews surrounding it on all sides. So that is fine. But Christian practice was that the altar, all the action takes place up front. There's nothing in the middle. Everything is up front, and then all the people sit behind there. Bima Ba'emtza became a symbol of an Orthodox shul. That you have to have a bima be'emtza. You may notice that one of the first things that the Reform did, followed by the conservatives, is that like the Christians, they put everything up in front. They read the Torah and the Chazan Davins from the exact same place in front of the shul, and everyone else is in back. That mimicked the German Protestant churches. And that's carried on to this day. So bima be'emtza became such a cri de cour, such a defining characteristic of a shul, because of the Christian influence, that dafka shuls will read the Torah from the middle and not from the front because of chukot akum. What's the issue? What's the problem? The problem is the Kesef Mishnah was asked this, or the Mechaber. I don't think he writes in the Shulchan Aruch though, but it is in the Kesef Mishnah. And he said, what's the big deal? A lot of Sephardic shuls, everything happens in the front. They daven, they lane, etc. Happens in the front. I'm sure he didn't use the word daven or lane, but you get the point. Why? Because they weren't subject to any Christian influence. That's why. It never, that idea, they had to distinguish themselves in their makom tefillah from Christianity, that never arose at all in the Sephardic world. Although you do see, as a general rule, the Sephardim will have the bima be'emtza, but they will also be very likely to daven from there in addition to read the Torah from there as well. Okay, anything else anyone else can think of? All right. As one other, some people, some of the Acharonim decried a bat mitzvah ceremony because it smacked too much of a confirmation ceremony that takes place in the Christian world. But I think that issue has been resolved also. So I'm sure there are others. These are just off the top of my head. But I want to just end looking at the areas of machshava where Jewish life changed or had to adjust itself because of Christianity. Yeah, so one thing is obvious. I thought someone even mentioned it. Clearly, Chanukah has taken on a significance beyond all proportion in Jewish life because of its competitor, so to speak, in America and Western societies. So that is a result of the Christian influence, as is, by the way, this notion of giving gifts on Hanukkah. That clearly is a Christian influence on Jewish life. But I wanted to mention two or three other points as well that relate to issues of machshava, hashkafa, etc. One comes out of the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Samach Amud Bet, in number 12. Darash Rabbi Yehuda bar Nachmani mitugmani de Rabbi Shimon Lakish. So Rish Lakish darshan as follows. K'tov l'cha tadver ma'ile. Write down these words. Uchtiv ki alpi hadvarim ha'ele. Alpi literally means, that's the according to, but by the mouth of these words. Ha'ketzad. How do you have something that b'chtiva and also b'alpeh? Dvarim she'b'chtav yatar ashay la'omer alpeh. Things that are written in Tanakh, you can't recite orally. Meaning you're technically not allowed to quote a pasuk orally. So mekil, because usually it's familiar to us. But so too, Dvarim she'b'al peh, iyata rashay l'omer b'chtav. Something that's part of the Torah she'b'al peh, you can't write it down. So we know the Talmud, or Torah she'b'al peh, was not meant to be written down in a Talmud. It was done because of Eid Lasot Lashem, Eferet Tartecha. We had no choice. It would have been lost otherwise. But here's the point. Another point. Debei Rabbi Shmuel Tana. Eile? Mi'apiyad v'rma Eile? Eile ta kotev. V'yat kotev halachot. You write the Torah, you don't have a compendium of halachot. Omer b'yochanan. Lo karat ha-kadosh baruch hu brit im Yisrael ela b'shvil dorim sheba'alpeh. Shenemar. The pasuk we quoted earlier, ki al pi advar me'ela karati itcha brit v'et Yisrael. It's because of the, so to speak, oral aspect of the Torah that I enacted this covenant with you and with the Jewish people. Meaning, what's the source of the brit, the covenant of Torah between God and the Jewish people? It's the Torah she'bal peh. It's not the Torah she'bichtav. Why is it not the Torah she'bichtav? Because the Torah she'bichtav, by the time of Rish Lakish, had already been co-opted by Christians as well, and centuries later, by Muslims also. So therefore, from that time until today, we extol the centrality of the Torah she'ba'al peh, and not the Torah she'bichtav, not Tanakh. And that led to the unfortunate circumstance of the de-emphasis on Tanakh, which still endures in Jewish life. And I imagine it's no different here than most yeshivas. Most yeshivas are very Talmud-centric. What's yeshiva? You sit and learn Gemara. You learn Tanakh. Maybe every now and then someone will give a shiur in Parsha. But to study Tanakh systematically, that's like something the Christians do. Or in a different context, that's what the Maskilim did. That's not for us. It's said of the Malbim, you've heard of the Malbim? They said of him, he was as great or greater a genius than Reb Chaim Brisker was. But the Malbim decided to focus, he was rough of a town, but he decided to focus his intellectual energy in writing a commentary to all of Tanakh, which he did, which utilizes a similar methodology, defining each word, differentiating between words which seem to be synonymous, defining each concept. He did to Tanakh what Reb Chaim did to Gemara. But nonetheless, he started because the Malbim saw that Tanakh was underanalyzed. It was underserved to our detriment. I have to tell you a story without names. Many years ago, I was probably just a couple years older than you, I went to hear a debate between two rabbanim, both of whom I know very well, the question of whether rabbis should make aliyah. Meaning, is it better for rabbis to stay in America and teach their flock, or make aliyah? Because like every Jew has to make aliyah. So in the end, they concluded that rabbis should stay in America until they finish their work, so to speak, and then they could move on. But in the middle of the debate, one of the rabbis said the following, and I remember to this day, he's quoted Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who said once that the Christians stole the Tanakh from us, and the Maskilim stole Hebrew from us, and the Zionists stole Eretz Yisrael from us. And by that he meant that in the Torah world, things became less popular when they became identified with a class that was Michutz L'machaneh. So in fact, the Christians became the students of the Bible, because we had the Talmud. And the Maskilim hated Yiddish, and those who spoke it, and so there were Yiddish among them also, but nonetheless, they popularized Hebrew. They started publishing magazines and newspapers in Hebrew in the mid-19th century, unprecedented in Jewish life. People spoke Hebrew for holy purposes, Lashon HaKodesh, either Tefillah, Talmud Torah. Everything else was in Yiddish or Ladino, Arabic, depending on where you live. And the Zionists, even the secular Zionists, took Eretz Yisrael, so it became, you know, unpopular that religious should get involved. All right? So that's what he quoted Rabbi Yaakov as saying, and the other rabbi gave this retort, which was like hitting the ball out of the park. He said, the Christians didn't steal the Tanakh from us. We stopped studying it. And the Maskilim didn't steal Lashon HaKodesh from us. We stopped speaking it. And the Zionists didn't steal Eretz Yisrael from us. We stopped going there and settling it. And that was the end. But you see, the notion that study of Tanakh became somewhat inferior to study of Gemara, I think that idea entered Jewish life because of its association with Christianity. And one other point worthy of mentioning, and that is the codification of beliefs of what Jews profess. So, of course, it's all based on the Tanakh and the Gemara. There's no doubt about that. But nonetheless, there always persisted, I think until, you don't really hear this much anymore, but there always persisted this urban myth that Yadus doesn't profess anything, but rather the essence of Judaism is deeds, mitzvot. We have things to do. We don't have a system of beliefs. Like, for example, Catholics have a catechism that they believe in, creeds that the pious among them recite every day. Of course it's false. Meaning this notion that there are no dogma in Jewish life is, of course, false. But for centuries it wasn't necessary to clarify what we professed, because Jews lived it. Right? We don't have to talk about Mashiach, Olam Haba, the nature of God, etc. The Chachamim knew, the Hamonim were involved in Talmud Torah Mitzvot. That's what it was. There was no challenge to the ideas of Judaism from paganism. It was considered way beneath us. But then the Christians had their catechism, and the Nicene Creed, and they recited it constantly. And people wondered, where do we differ from them? Do we embrace them? There's always a tremendous pressure on Jews to convert to Christianity since it had emerged from Judaism. And then came along Reb Sadra Gaon in the 10th century. It wasn't directly a response to Christianity, but nonetheless, it was out there. The Kuzari, of course, was in that sense, as was the Rambam and the Ramban and many, many others until today, who assembled what it is the Jewish people stand for and profess, and what we have to say fundamentally about God and life and creation and purpose and Olam Haba and the Torah and Schar Va'onesh and Mashiach v'chule v'chule. This notion of codifying what it is that Jews believe to a great extent was a reaction to Christianity. There has been this influence. It's not as great. I mean, those old details, it's not as great as people think, but it isn't non-existent. But there's no doubt since Christianity was a reaction or an outgrowth of Judaism, many of the things that they do are just like the antithesis of what we do. We have Shabbat on Saturday, Saturday through Sunday, because they're not going to, for centuries, by the way, the Christians observe their Sabbath on Shabbat also, because that's what the Jews did until Constantine, the I don't want to say the great, yeah, he was all right in certain senses, but the Constantine, the all right, changed it. And since then, except for the Seventh-day Adventists, it's always on Sunday. So there is this influence. Mainly it's keeping things away or delineating where we differ, but we should be aware of it as how it's influenced Jewish life over the centuries as well. Okay, any questions? Very good. I thank you all very much.